With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, it's the 500th episode of Little Atoms, and I'm talking to author Philip Hensher about his latest novel, The Friendly Ones. Philip Hensher has written 10 novels, including The Mulberry Empire, the Booker shortlisted The Northern Clemency, King of the Badgers, and Scenes from Early Life, which won the Ondaatje Prize in 2012. He's also a professor of creative writing at the University of Bath Spa. And Philip's latest novel, which we're going to talk about today, is The Friendly Ones. Philip, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
So how would you describe The Friendly Ones, Philip?
It's a story about two families living next door to each other and the way that their lives run in parallel and then start to intertwine. It's set in provincial England. The thing about these two families is that they come from very different parts of the world originally, and their stories really start to involve much larger questions about kind of societies and how societies intermingle and how societies absorb people who aren't from the same place. It's about getting used to people who aren't the same as us, I reckon. I wrote it in quite an exploratory spirit. I don't really know what I was aiming to prove when I set out on the book, and I think those questions remain quite open at the end of the book too.
So it's set in the main. There's parts of it is set in Bangladesh, which we'll get to later on, but it's set in the main in Sheffield.
Yeah,
beginning roughly around the 1980s. You also grew up in Sheffield, would have been around this era as well. You've written previously also about the city, but how much of your Sheffield is in this book?
Well, it's the nice thing about Sheffield is that not many people have written books about it. You set a book in Venice or Oxford, and it's been thoroughly gone over by all sorts of people. There's a particular joy about writing about a city that you know very, very intimately, that you don't feel once you start writing about a particular building or a turn of a street that this is going to call, you know, Henry James or whoever to mind. There's a lot of my Sheffield in it. There's a lot of the particular mood of the city in it. I think cities have manners. They have ways of negotiating with each other and of talking, and I hope that a lot of that is in it.
This is a long book, and it's multi-generational, multi-families, lots of characters, goes backwards and forwards in time, and this has really become your thing. The Northern Clemency, again, was a similar setting. The Emperor Waltz, we could say as well, although it goes much further back in time, is a similar thing. Why do you like this sort of style?
Well, I think novelists have a particular length that they move quite naturally at. If you look at the collected works of any given novelist, they're often, you know, the same sort of length. Most of Dickens' novels are roughly the same length. They're about twice as long, actually, as this book, so you got off lightly there. I think that the length of it is not a conscious decision. I mean, sometimes I've started a book thinking, oh, this time I'm going to write a very, very short novel. I'm going to write an exquisite, tiny, you know, 70,000-word novel, and it just kind of seems to expand. I think there's a relationship between the number of people in a novel and the length of it. You need space to go into people's lives. You need space to go into the way that they interact with each other. And I just like a novel with, as a reader, I like a novel with a lot of characters in it. And I think actually it's something to do with, I guess, you know, being interested in a range of human beings and liking a wide range of human beings. Sometimes when I read a novel and there's three characters in it and some walk-on parts that are dismissed with, you know, dismissed without proper investigation, I start to wonder, does the person who wrote this, do they like the human race? I don't know. I certainly do like the human race. And I'm always kind of drawn by those kind of glimpses in the street of somebody whose life just touches your own for a moment and then goes off to who knows where, really.
And the one difference with this book from the previous ones, perhaps, is that you've included one of the families that you talk about is from an immigrant background. Hmm. You've written before about Bangladesh. Tell us something about your connection to that country.
Well, I'm married to a Bangladeshi national. And I guess Bangladesh one always knew about, and it sort of touched one's life in ways on the news, and I knew that in so-called Indian restaurants in this country are always run by Bangladeshis, almost always run by Bangladeshis. Not only that, run by Bangladeshis from Sylhet, and those things I sort of knew. And then I met my husband nearly 20 years ago now, and to be absorbed into Bengali society, it's a very kind of interesting process, and the story that they all have to tell is a very kind of painful one, and about the founding of the country and the violence in which it erupted. And I really didn't know about it. You know, I'd never actually heard of the names of the founders of the country. And I never knew the scale of the genocide, really, in 1971, before the country was founded. And I felt that there's a big question there about justice, because none of the perpetrators of the genocide have ever been brought to justice. But there's also a question about us not knowing, us in as white English people, not knowing about any of this, even though, you know, we certainly know people from this community, and if we'd bothered to talk to them about their history, we would probably find quite quickly that they had uncles who were, you know, who were murdered. They might even have, you know, cousins who played rather a dishonourable part, but we just don't know because we don't talk to them. I mean, we talk to them, but we don't talk to them about it. And I started to wonder, because like a lot of English people, I've always had this rather complacent idea that in this country, the white English, they're rather good at racial relations. They're quite relaxed about, you know, being polite to people who are not like them for the most part. And then I thought, well, it's partly true. And partly, even if it is true, it's largely at the cost of politely not asking people anything about themselves, really. It's as if these kind of long histories that people carry with them, sometimes deeply traumatic, they're kind of carried with them as a sort of secret, and that's the price of being admitted to our company. So I thought that the book might do something to undo that, really, and just to, you know, present the reader with the kind of with the assimilated surface before ripping up that surface and going back to the origins.
And we should say this is something that's happened within our lifetimes. It's not ancient history. Tell us something about what happened. Not the once the independent movement, this is 1971, there's a man, Banga Bandhu, the friend of Bengal, as he's alluded to in the book, who's one of the sort of heads of the independence movement. 1971, the country starts taking steps towards independence, and then there is basically a genocide.
Well, what became Bangladesh was the eastern half of Pakistan. It was ruled from Islamabad, and Islamabad had had a long history of trying to suppress Bengali culture. And Bengali culture is very rich. It's primarily a sort of secular culture, although, you know, the unifying thing was supposed to be religion. It's fair to say that for most Bengalis, the thing they were proudest of was, you know, poetry and music and art and literature.
And film that we would know.
And film, Satyajit Ray, yeah. Of course. So it began very badly after independence in 1947, and Islamabad tried to suppress Bengali as a language altogether, and there were riots and people were killed. There's a monument to the martyrs of the language movement in the early 1950s in Bethnal Green, actually a reproduction of half size of one that's in Dhaka, and this sort of went on in a very kind of tense way all through the 1960s, and national radio was forbidden from broadcasting Bengali songs and poetry. And finally, in the end of the 1960s, the general election produced the result that Bongabondo Sheikh Mujib ought to be the president of Pakistan, and this wasn't accepted. The result wasn't accepted, and that was really the trigger for the declaration of a new state. Bongabondo, in March 1971, there was a famous meeting at the racetrack, and he didn't actually announce it, but he might as well have announced it. And at that point, the Pakistani troops moved in and carried out a savage war between March and December 1971. I think the cruelest thing of the whole war, and the thing that is deeply shocking, is that 10 days or so before the end of the war, when India came in on the side of Bangladesh, and really it was clear that Pakistan were going to lose very, very quickly, Pakistan embarked on a strategy of killing as many intellectuals, poets, and writers as they could find, and some of the really great figures of Bengali culture were murdered in that week. And as I say, nobody has ever faced justice for what they did.
And that was just to basically undermine the sort of nascent Bengali culture.
They wanted to cripple the nation that was about to be born.
And so the title of this book, The Friendly Ones, alludes both to the people in the UK that the immigrants meet who are friendly to them rather than reject them, but also has a more sinister meaning back in Bangladesh.
Well, it is actually my invention, because the real name of this organisation, Bengali Friends, said to me that it would be just very shocking and upsetting to see a book titled after this. The real name of the organisation was the Peace Committee, and it was an organisation of collaborators and informers that that basically existed to hand over Bengali nationalists to the Pakistani authorities when many of them were tortured and murdered. Some of those collaborators have in the last few years been prosecuted in Bangladesh, but it's been a very, very slow process, and the process of prosecution has been hedged around with all sorts of difficult questions.
I'm Ian Sinclair, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's talk about the two families for a while. So let's start with the spinsters. At the beginning of the book, we meet the Sharifullah family are having this party. Hilary Spinster is a retired doctor. He's sort of like nosing over the fence, sort of taking too long to trim something in the garden, wants to see what's going on. Introduces to Hilary and his, I mean, we won't be able to go through them all, but some of his enormous clan.
Well, the spinsters came from a very curious observation that a lot of friends of mine started making. About three or four times people came to me and said, my God, you know, my parents, they've been married for 40 or 50 years, and I really think they might be about to get a divorce. They just row all the time. And I don't know what it is. It does seem to me that, you know, I don't think the divorce rate is really very high among people in their 80s, but I think it's really, it could be a tense moment. And what happens to the spinsters? Hillary's wife, they haven't been happy for years, and it goes back to an affair that that his wife had in the 1960s, 30 years before. And Hillary just decides that he wants to put things right before his wife dies. She's very ill with cancer, and he just announces to his children that he's going to divorce her. And the children arrive. There are four of them. They're all a little bit damaged, I would say. They have... They haven't quite lived up to expectations, and they have a sort of dysfunctional relationship with their father. They can't quite work out why it's so dysfunctional, I suppose. And it was really, and there were lots of things about them that were a puzzle to me at first. And I could hear why they were arguing with each other or not arguing with each other, kind of walking away from arguments with each other. And I could feel how pugnacious they were and how quick to take offence. And it really puzzled me for ages why they were like this. I could feel that they were. And then one day I was about 300 pages into the novel, I suddenly realised that they have a particular physical peculiarity that they all share. They're all extremely short. Now, I'm not saying that all short people are like this by any means, but that was why they felt like they did, why they sort of clung together, and also why they felt that the world was slightly strange to them. It wasn't quite suited to them. So it kind of went on from there, really.
You mentioned the Hillary's decision to divorce Celia, and as appalling as this sounds, actually, she might be up for it herself. There's this one great scene that I was really struck by where Leo, the son, goes to visit Celia in hospital just before he basically leaves for the rest of the book. Leaves the family, he's still a character in the book, in sort of like one of the central dramas of the story. And she says to him, you know, I should have walked away. There was a point where I made a mistake. And that mistake was basically your life, which is an incredible image, I think.
Yes, it's one of those things that people say from time to time, but I don't think it's necessarily true. And I think if you do walk away, often it's just into another thing, which might turn into a mistake. Yes, it is certainly true that those things, you know, they're very painful. But the one thing that we all ought to learn from family life is people are much tougher than we expect they're going to be. You know, it's one of those things that people people are very, very rarely killed by an extreme piece of news or information or something that somebody says to them.
Just say something about each of Hillary and Celia's children. So I've mentioned Leo at the start of the book. At the start of the story, he's a journalist. Then there's Blossom, Lavinia and Hugh. Just tell us something about each of those briefly.
Well, Leo is really formed by one of the worst failures that can happen to a child in middle class life is that he's defeated by university and walks away from it. And I think he's never really going to get over that. The thing that happens to Leo is that, and actually this became more of a hot subject while I was writing the book, is that his life is really destroyed by him saying really the wrong thing to a woman, something that is not, you know, within the bounds of acceptability at all. And the woman shares this information with other people and his life is destroyed by it. Now, I don't think, you know, it's an interesting point, this, really. And sexual harassment and so on has become, you know, a very hot topic recently. And I personally think that these things exist on a continuum. And at one end, you know, we've got rapists and people for whom, you know, no does not mean no. On the other end, we've got people, and I think Leo is maybe one of them, who says something inappropriate and the person he says it to says, that's not going to happen. And he probably says, oh, okay, I'm sorry, you know.
And we should say he says this inappropriate thing because it's been extremely successful for him in the past.
Yeah, but it hasn't been extremely successful with him with this woman. You know, that's the thing. You know, just because you say things and they're mostly successful. I remember at university, there was a guy who lived in the basement of our student house who claimed that he asked every woman he ever met if she'd have sex with him. And I said, surely they don't. What? And he said, well, 95 out of 100 say no, but 5 say yes. And I was like, how can you live your life like that? And if there's something wrong with it, well, there's obviously something wrong with it. It's very wrong. But where does that kind of behaviour stand, you know, in relation to Harvey Weinstein, or you know, that or that taxi driver that drugged and raped women? I think that it's a good question. It's a question for a novel, really. It's not a question for you know, in the end, it's going to be a question for policymakers. But I think that it's a good question for a novel because it's an exploratory question.
This is the sort of straw that breaks the camel's back that leads Leo to leave Oxford. But he's already suffering. He's not sort of meeting people. He's having a bad time. And I understand that this reflects your own experience in Oxford somewhat.
Yes. Yes, it does, actually. I mean, not the sexual harassment part. But I was somehow conspicuous. And I think that period, that moment at the beginning of university, there's a sort of panicked rushing together into small clans. And I've never been much of a clanny person. And I guess I didn't, before I knew it, I was quite isolated for really quite a few months. And an isolated person in those situations, particularly somebody who, like me, had gone to university and was too nervous to come out as gay, you're evidently hiding something. You know, you're isolated. You are the target for some pretty bad behaviour, I would say. And, you know, there's stuff like, you know, there was stuff in the book like Leo having his door banged on and people yelling outside his door and, you know, and stuff like that that happened to me. But, you know, you just have to be strong about it and get back in there and get on with it. And it was fine in the end, but there's not many people from my undergraduate degree that I still see.
And there's another way of dealing with that. There's a character in the book called Tom Dick who also comes from Sheffield, like Liam, from a, you know, a more, well, I mean, I guess they're middle class, but, you know, from a less salubrious background than most of his Oxford contemporaries, who just reinvents himself.
Yeah, that was a phenomenon of the time. People pushing themselves up the social scale. And it was very evident that when some of the people I was at university with were picked up by their parents at the end of the first term, that the parents were a bit kind of surprised at what their son or daughter was now wearing and the way that they were now talking. That's an interesting phenomenon. I've often wondered what happened to those people afterwards. Did they go on talking like that? Did they go on pretending? Did they go on talking about their uncle's house in the country? I don't know. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Philip Hensher. We're talking about his latest novel, The Friendly Ones. And Philip, let's move on to the Sharifullah family. So Sharif and Nazia, who are the head of this family in the UK, they've come over from Bangladesh relatively recently, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But as the book begins, again, they're holding this party for a housewarming party, which is for their third or fourth house in Sheffield that they've moved into. Tell us something about those and their children.
Well, I loved them. Sometimes you're interested by characters in a novel, and sometimes you just love a pair of characters. And the more I wrote about them, the more they interested me. And I think the thing that that very much interested me in the pair of them, and it's something that that I find in my husband's immediate family, and in my husband indeed himself, is that they have a very healthy relationship to the argumentative conversation. They're very happy about sitting down to dinner and starting a good old scrap about what we should do about some human rights issue or something like that, and it can get quite furious, and then it comes to an end, and then it's absolutely fine. There's an engagement with ideas there. There's a kind of respect for other people's points of view that I could see after a bit was a very powerful underpinning of that marriage, really. They're quite different people, I think. You know, Sharif is really, you know, somebody who sort of shrugs and gets on with things. He has a kind of steely core. If you get to the wrong point, he will turn and bite. But for the most part, he's quite kind of calm and amiable. She's much more ambitious, I think, in worldly ways, and I think that that makes her slightly vulnerable. If you pin your identity on what you're going to achieve, then sometimes that just falls to the floor, and then you don't have very much, really. But see how that worked out, and to see that they were going to be extremely good parents. I mean, there was no question that they were going to make great success of being parents to their children, as opposed to the spinsters next door.
And indeed, they are a great success. All of their children are very successful. Yes. Let's talk about Aisha, who's... Yeah. I mean, I guess with Leo is possibly the main sort of drivers of the plot in the story in the UK section. So is she?
Yeah. Well, she comes to the UK when she's eight. So she's kind of the youngest member of the family to have some kind of experience of assimilation. And I've often thought that there's a particular age of self-consciousness that really turns people into a particular, gives people a particular mindset, makes them look at the world in a particular, slightly detached way. Her brothers who are born in the UK, I don't think have that at all. But she always knows that this is a little bit provisional, I think. I don't think she thinks like her parents do that the moment might come when the génocidaire come over the hill and they're going to have to pack their bags again. But she does think that the friendships that she's being offered are not quite as reliable as they might be in other directions.
You mentioned the Sherry Fuller family. They are really appealing. They're a great family. They're a success. They also have this incredibly interesting and tragic backstory.
Yes.
How do you, when you're writing this, as you're going along, how do you balance the two sort of sets of families? Because one could quite easily sort of overshadow the other.
Oh, Lord, I don't know. I think that's a question for the editing stage, really, to think, oh, there's a bit too much of this, you know. And I thought about the way that the book was going to be structured very early on, and the first half of the book is the spinster family and the Sharavullas are kind of coming in as the kind of amiable neighbours, but their story isn't really being told except in tiny snatches. And then in the second half, I thought this story is of such kind of gravity and importance that it deserves to be told in a consistent way, you know, not by intertwining it, but simply by giving the reader the real chance to be absorbed in their particular trajectory. So, in a way, that was quite an easy way to make sure that they weren't that it was being balanced, because you know this is the spinster's half of the book. They can take charge, and then you know this is Sharif and Nazia's side. You know, I'm going to listen to them talking for a bit.
I'm Rachel Cook, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's go back in time a little bit to the early 70s then, and over to Dan Mondi, the place in Dakar where the house is. Sherry's brother, Rafiq, who is he?
Rafiq is a freedom fighter, and the people who fought for the liberation of Bangladesh, they're a very brave bunch of people. They're national heroes. Now, a lot of them were very young. You know, Rafiq in the book is 17 years old. That was quite commonplace. And he goes on, but he's also, you know, that particular group of people, they were very, very vulnerable to being denounced by the collaborators. They were, you know, they knew the risks they were taking. And a lot of them, you know, were disappeared into Pakistani police stations and were never heard of again. There's a great memoir of the period by a writer called Jayanara Imam. It is just about translated into English, not very well. It's quite hard to get hold of. And she tells the story of her son who was disappeared in exactly this way, and I thought I would draw on her experience. Really, she's a very good teller of what happened.
And another one of Sharif's family, a sister, Sadia, she's married to a more devout man called Mahfouz, who,
yes.
Well, as far as the family is concerned, has betrayed the family.
They know as much as they could possibly know.
Let's talk a little bit about Mahfouz. Tell us something about who he is.
Mahfouz is a... He's somebody from a much more conventional and religious family than the Sharifullahs. The sister who marries him is a bit of a cuckoo in the family. She longs for a more conventional way of living. She asks if they will arrange a marriage for her, which is really unheard of in these secular intellectual Bengali families. They just wouldn't, you know, they're one of the things that they're absolutely devoted to and have been for, you know, over 100 years, is that women should be properly educated and should have professions. So that would be an absolute anathema to them. Mahfouz comes from this conventional family. Is also that sort of family rates religion over secular culture, and so would be naturally more, you know, attuned to the Pakistani government in Islamabad. A lot of those people did become collaborators. He, because of what happens in Bangladesh after independence, he and Sadia flee to England, and they take up their lives here. And then a few years later, the political situation in Bangladesh changes, and the rest of the family start to think, you know, that they ought to go to England as well. But they only ever meet once again, and I think that's probably quite a common experience in families that were divided like this.
There's another sequence in the book where, without giving too much away, Mahfouz, Sadia's died at some point off screen, and Mahfouz has been married to somebody else.
Yes.
They go on a honeymoon to Land's End, and it's Cornwall, of course. Everybody's staring at these people. She's obviously covered up.
Yes.
And I thought that was a really sympathetic portrayal of that excursion, yes, for these, considering Mahfouz is basically the villain of the book.
Well, yes, I think even villainous people, they're capable of love, really. And she's not villainous. She's a girl. I was really interested, really, in that chapter. It was a hard chapter to write, and it was the one that I did get friends who know that that community to go over with a fine-tooth comb. I was very interested in addressing that kind of experience in an art form that nobody in that chapter would go anywhere near. You know, if you're a fundamentalist, if you're a fundamentalist in that sense, you know, it would be pretty unlikely, I would think, that you would find yourself in a position where you'd want to read a book like The Friendly Ones. So how do you address that without making them seem like a sort of alien kind of presence, really? How do you write about it without you know, trying to enter into their feelings, rather than making it seem like it's a chapter about, I don't know, you know, an animal or something? I enjoyed writing it, and I, you know, there were a number of practical problems that had to be solved, explaining how it was that this couple could go on honeymoon and that sort of thing. And friends gave me a lot of helpful advice about that. I think that in the end, I was quite glad to finish writing that chapter. It was quite difficult to be in those heads.
One other thing about the book, and then I'll get you to read some if you would. Obviously, Hillary has basically, as we go through the book, alienated most of his own family. And he gradually gets absorbed into the Sharifullah family. And what develops is this really great and touching friendship over the years between Sharif and Hillary. And they become like, you know, best buddies. It's really great. Tell me something about that journey.
Well, the thing about Hillary, and the reason that his family are so dysfunctional, is that no one will ever argue with him. And, you know, whenever he says something controversial in the morning listening to Radio 4, they just say, oh, if you say so, really, you know, just wander off. And he meets Sharif, and suddenly, you know, writing the book, it all made sense. It all made sense what Hillary needed and why Sharif, in this kind of joyously argumentative way, was there. And they meet after Celia has died. They ask him round for dinner in a polite way. And the dinner turns into a real grand old Barney. And at the end of it, you know, they just realise that they need each other and they like each other. They disagree about everything, but that's the sound basis of a friendship. Of course, after that, his children, they notice that all this has happened and they understand, and then they start trying to have arguments with him, but he won't. He's faithful to Sharif in his arguments.
Could I get you to read a bit of the... Do you want this?
Of course.
Do you want mine?
Yeah, thank you. Well, one of the key episodes of the book, I mean, it is about the encounter between two cultures in this country. And one of the most painful, probably the most painful moments of encounter was the 7/7 bombings. And one of the characters is killed in the 7/7 bombings, and his sister afterwards, is who loves him more than anybody, is really tormented by the imagination of his last moments. She tried to explain to her husband how it was that a solid feature of the room she lived in had been removed at a stroke, and one felt first of all that the room would collapse. It was a structural feature, surely a load-bearing one, and then she saw that it was holding up together for the moment. It was more than she could bear to hear anyone, even Jeremy, talk about religion in any context. In those first days of love, you could find yourself talking with intensity and commitment on almost any subject, gazing into the face of a loved one. It would have been the same if Jeremy had been a microbiologist instead of a vicar. Now it was gone. Poor stupid Russell, her son, bovine, fire engine obsessed, solidly repetitive, a stranger from the moment of his birth, was bewildered by his mummy. Jeremy knew too well what to do. He had no mood of crumpled grief himself. He had gone into the kind, sad, supportive figure that he impersonated once a week for near strangers in his congregation. He had never met Hugh, and he had no grief, only concern for his wife. He could not feel the wind that was tearing through the hole left in the universe by violent design. She wanted to apologise. Most of all, she could not stop constructing the minutes before it had happened. Hugh running for the bus, then seeing that there were a lot of people shoving to get on. Something must have happened to the tube that morning. It was always happening. He must have been one of the last on a very full bus. Just by him, a man was sitting in one of the disabled seats with a rucksack on his knees. That rucksack would really get on people's nerves in a crowded bus or tube. Was he a tourist, that poor man? He was sitting and muttering into his phone and perspiring there in his seat. The rucksack had been a mistake, the man was coming to understand during a London morning rush hour. He was clutching it tight, trying to stop it spilling over onto his neighbour's knees. Hugh had raised his head. He had caught the eye of a girl, a pretty girl from a Chinese family. Her hair scrunched up in a sort of perm, and her eyes dropped. She had recognised him from some advert. The muttering from the man in the seat just by him was continuing. It had a fierce quality, the sound under the breath. Hugh couldn't see, but he wasn't quite certain that the man was talking into a mobile phone after all. The bus was turning off Euston Road, down towards Tavistock Square. Travelling in the morning on public transport in London, you quickly learnt the importance of treating other people with respect and consideration. Hugh very much hoped he wasn't going to be late for the 10 o'clock start of rehearsals. He told himself firmly that there was all the time in the world.
I've been talking to Philip Henshaw. We've been talking about his latest novel, The Friendly Ones, which is out now from Fourth Estate. Philip, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up. and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.